ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
She's the tough former prosecutor who became responsible for monitoring the reintegration of Victoria's most dangerous criminals.
It does have that lovely irony about it. I was asking for life sentences and here I am now saying, no, these people need to be treated and rehabilitated.
Michelle Williams KC, who's just stepped down as the chair of Victoria's post-sentence authority. You'll meet her here shortly on The Law Report. Hi, Damien Carrick with you. Donald Trump's criminal trial relating to paying hush money to former adult film star Stormy Daniels has begun in a New York courtroom. This followed an intense week-long jury selection process. Cornell University law professor Valerie Hans is an expert in juries. Valerie, walk me through the vetting process which took place last week. It's very different to what would happen here in Australia. Large groups of prospective jurors, up to 96 at a time, were brought into the courtroom, and at that point they were asked a single question. What was that question?
Well, they were asked, could you be fair and impartial in a trial of Donald Trump? And that was enough for 50 of the 96 in the very first group to raise their hands and say, no, I could not be fair and impartial in this trial.
So about 50% in each group said that they could not be fair and impartial. What was the next step for those who maintained they could be fair and impartial?
The remaining individuals were asked a set of 42 questions, some of which had subparts, and each of the sides, the prosecution and the defense, was given an opportunity to ask follow-up questions on individual jurors. And they had the opportunity to ask the judge to eliminate those jurors on the basis of their responses that and the side's judgment that they couldn't be fair and impartial. So it's a really thorough process, and yet it was surprisingly efficient and got done in a week.
Indeed, the expectation was that it would take perhaps several weeks, but it all got done very quickly. Can we talk about some of these questions? They included where the person lived, their marital status, their employment, their educational status, their hobbies, what media they consume, whether they belong to groups like Antifa or the Proud Boys, whether or not they had a close friend or relative who worked for a company owned by Trump. But they weren't asked directly who they voted for and what their political affiliation was.
The judge, I think, rightly said, who you vote for is not the business of the court. We don't have a right to ask you what you do in the privacy of the ballot box. And he made a similar judgment in terms of party affiliation. Although whether or not you are a registered Republican or a registered Democrat is actually public knowledge. And I'm guessing both sides would have had that information going into the jury selection.
Because they had the name of the juror and then they just kind of typed them into the database or into Google or whatever.
Yes, the judge made a decision that is, I think it was as best as he could do given New York law. He decided that this jury would be anonymous to the public. But New York law requires that the parties be able to know the individual name and some limited information about the individuals who are prospective jurors in the case so they can do some background research. And actually, we saw that background research revealed some social media posts that wound up leading the judge to remove some jurors for cause.
Yes, indeed. But before we get to that, and some really interesting examples of that, including in the 42 questions, there was the question, do you follow Trump on social media? Do you have strong opinions or firmly held beliefs about Donald Trump and the fact that he's a candidate for president? And also what media you consume, which perhaps is a bit of a giveaway. People are being asked questions, but not right on point.
You know, if you look at answers to all 42 of the questions, you can probably figure out whether, for example, somebody is a Democrat or is a Republican, or at least leans one way or the other, because the recognition of the links between media consumption and party affiliation are pretty clear. And the way in which people responded to some of the questions about their attitudes toward Trump and their political leanings also were clear. I was intrigued at the candor of the jurors who responded in the courtroom.
There were some fascinating exchanges. There was one prospective juror who works in a bookshop, and he said, quote, "If I was sitting in a bar, I'd be happy to tell you, but in this room, what I feel about President Trump is not important." The judge dismissed him.
He makes a good point, though, right? I mean, he makes a good point. You can spout off to individuals, to your friends, to family, and to people sitting next to you at the bar, but that is different from the way you're going to treat a defendant in a criminal trial. And yet, people who have very strong views when they're spouting off to family, friends, and people in a bar are also likely to be influenced by those views when they look at evidence in a case. So again, I like the candor of this juror, but I also recognize that the parties very much want to know if this is the kind of person who would be spouting very strong views in the bar.
There was one potential juror who said she could be fair, but then she was confronted by the defense team with social media posts that they found, which she had made in the past, including one in which she called Trump a racist and a sexist. So confronted with these, she said, quote, "Whoops, that sounds bad." And then she was dismissed at that point. So no surprises there, perhaps.
Yes. And I think that's one new technique that parties have now is looking at the internet presence of individuals and seeing whether or not what they say in the presence of the judge and the lawyers and giving sworn testimony in court is actually lines up with what they say outside, and especially social media posts, many of which could be political in our polarized times. Whether or not those line up is, you know, something of great interest to the parties.
We all have a digital footprint. Now, some of the jurors who were selected earlier on in the week subsequently were dismissed. The media reported in great detail about one juror, a cancer nurse, who came back to the court. She's selected and came back to the court on Thursday and said, "Look, my friends, family and colleagues have identified me from press reports and I just don't want to continue now that I've been identified to those people." And the judge said, "Yes, okay, I understand that," and dismissed her. And then another juror, prosecutors, not defense team, came back and said the following day after he'd been selected, "You answered the question, have you ever been arrested? And you said no, but we found on the internet that you had actually been, or somebody with your name had been arrested for pulling down political posters back in the 1990s. So you weren't completely honest with us and we want this person dismissed." So people, they get selected and then they get deselected for a range of reasons.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing that probably could have been discovered had the jurors completed questionnaires in advance and had both sides had a chance to review each individual in more detail. But in fact, the jurors only got the set of questions once they arrived at the courthouse. And you know, I can understand the rationale, because if you got a questionnaire asking you lots of questions about Donald Trump, you would know immediately what trial you were likely to be serving on. So I can understand that as a decision made by the judge, but it did interfere a bit with pretrial research about the prospective jurors. On the juror who was removed because she was now concerned that friends and family had likely recognized her as a Trump juror because of what media had covered, that is quite worrisome. It's worrisome because it makes me concerned that jurors are going into this trial with some level of concern about public reaction to whatever verdict they might reach. And you'd like the jurors to be able to sit in the courtroom, have not a care in the world about whether or not the individuals outside the courtroom are going to like or hate what they do, and really concentrate on the evidence in the case. And so that is worrisome. It does raise issues about the safety of jurors should the decision come down to something that people do not like. We've had other cases, not this particular one yet, but other cases where jurors have been doxxed that is, information about them has been publicized. And I worry that something like that could happen in this case because of the detail about the individuals that has been released to the media.
Well, really interesting. I've been reading it in various outlets, you know, paragraphs on each of the jurors. Jury one will be the foreman, works in sales and lives in West Harlem. He said he enjoys outdoor activities. He said he gets his news from the New York Times and watches Fox News and MSNBC. He said that he'd heard about some of the former President Donald Trump's other criminal cases, but did not have an opinion about them, about him or them. Really interesting. I'm wondering, yeah, it won't be hard for some people to who know these people to join the dots, I would have thought.
We know a lot more about these jurors than we do most juries in most trials. So it's not like this is common that lots and lots of detail is learned about prospective jurors. But in this case, the 42 questions give lots of information that probably compromises anonymity. So we know a lot more about the prospective jurors, and I think that's going to be helpful for both sides because they can take a look at who's on the jury right now and think about whether or not the trial strategy that they have planned is going to work well with these individuals.
So they can pitch their messaging, they can pitch their questioning, in light of what they know about the juror?
Yes, yes.
And how would they do that?
Well, this jury is a highly educated jury, and the prosecution has a very strong documentary record to present. And so I think they will have some confidence in presenting the documentary evidence that individuals on the jury are going to be able to understand that. So I think that's one of the ways in which knowing who's on your jury makes a difference in how you present the evidence in the case.
Absolutely fascinating. Professor Valerie Hans, law professor at Cornell University and the Charles F. Recklin Professor at the university. Look, thank you. Thank you very much for speaking to the Law Report.
My pleasure.
So, how different is the jury selection process here in Australia? Lawyer and psychologist Jane Goodman-Delahunty is an honorary professor at Newcastle University. Jane, here in this country, what information do the defence and prosecution have when they make a decision on whether or not to challenge a prospective juror?
They have extremely limited information, so there's no pretrial questionnaires about people's attitudes, beliefs, favorite TV shows, sources of news or hobbies, etc. What they get often on the morning of the trial, and sometimes maybe the night before, is a list of the potential jurors stating their occupation and their postcode or address, and then the juror name. Now, in open court, actually, in many jurisdictions now, the juror name is protected in order to provide more privacy and security to jurors. And so jurors may be referred to in court only by number, but the lawyers may have their name. And in some jurisdictions, when the trial begins and the jurors come into court for impanelment, the associate to the judge will read out the juror's name and their occupation. And then the lawyers have a chance to scrutinize the juror visibly, either when the juror walks from the general panel to the jury box or when the juror stands up in the jury box. And pretty much based on their appearance, they have to make a decision to challenge. So what they have available is some guesses or some hunches about maybe the socioeconomic status of the postcode, where the juror may reside, some inferences that they might make about their work, and all the rest is observational, such as juror gender, juror age, juror attire.
Apart from a general question put by the judge as to whether they feel they might be able to be a juror member, come to the case with impartiality and hear a case favourably, no other dialogue with the judge or the defence and prosecution team.
That's correct.
Professor Jane Goodman-Delahunty. So different approaches in different countries. Australia relies on appearances and stereotypes. The USA relies, in some cases, on detailed questioning. And in stark contrast, in England, there are no challenges allowed at all. Damien Carrick with you. Do follow the Law Report on the ABC Listen app. And if you find us on other podcast platforms, please do leave us a review, a like, a star rating, a thumbs up. It helps others find the program. Convicted criminals do the crime, serve the time, and then they earn their freedom. But what happens if a serious offender poses an ongoing, unacceptable risk to the community? How should they be managed, monitored, and treated? In Victoria, responsibility for answering those tricky questions is the job of the Post-Sentence Authority. Now, after 5 years as chair of the organisation, Michelle Williams KC has just stepped down and she joins me now. Michelle Williams, in a moment I'd like to talk about differing views on whether or not serious offenders should receive support from the NDIS, the National Disability Insurance Scheme. But to start, in a nutshell, what's the role of the Post-Sentence Authority?
The role of the Post-Sentence Authority is to monitor serious violent offenders and serious sex offenders, where there's legislation that sets out what the principles are, and the main principle is protection of the community. The second principle is treatment and rehabilitation of offenders. So those two things go hand in hand. Our role is not hands-on on the ground. We receive information from Corrections Victoria and we act on that information.
So it was created in about 2018.
That's right.
As of June 2023, there are 126 offenders subject to a post-sentence order, 92 serious sex offenders, 21 serious violent offenders, and 13 both serious sex and serious violent offenders. Now, to be subject to your organisation's authority, a judge has to make a determination that you are a serious ongoing risk to the community. What happens to those? In Victoria, I understand a lot of offenders subject to a PSO order, post-sentence order, they live in a residential complex called Corella Place, and it's known in Victoria as the Village of the Damned. Tell me about that unit.
Yes, that's right. So bear in mind, we are talking about people who have finished their sentence, but they have been deemed by the court to still pose an unacceptable risk. So Corella Place is one of perhaps the main residential place for sex offenders.
Tell me about this unit. It's outside of Ararat, which is about 2 hours northwest of Melbourne. Yeah. It's a secure residential complex where there are walls and electronic fences and everybody wears ankle bracelets. And if you leave, you must be accompanied.
Yes.
And there's a curfew and you can't use, well, I don't know, can you use phones and the internet?
No. Usually on their orders, there's a prohibition on certain technology. So that is strictly monitored. They are able to leave, but as you say, usually accompanied. When they're getting prepared to leave, that is a process, making sure that they're safe to leave. So it may be that we would give permission for them to leave on certain occasions, being unaccompanied, so that they're tested, if you like.
Nevertheless, they have the electronic ankle bracelets and what have you.
They do. So they might go out, leave to go to the shops or to do shopping or to visit a relative or to have coffee, but it's strictly monitored.
So people subject to this order, they go to this Village of the Damned outside of Ararat, and then after that they transition to community housing. What sorts of restrictions and monitoring do you have at that stage? Once they leave.
I think it's important to note that before we get to that stage, that, as I said, being able to leave Corella Place, I prefer to call it Corella Place rather than Village of the Dam because I think we've made some really successful inroads. But for them to be able to leave and live elsewhere, that's a process. It doesn't happen overnight. We need to make sure that they're able to do that safely. For example, a place might be obtained, a residential property that Corrections Victoria would come to us with what's called an environmental scan. Environmental scan is, if you like, a very detailed document about what the property is, where it is, for example, what can be found out about neighbours and so on, and as much as possible we have that information so that we can ensure that, one, the offender is still able to abide by the conditions of the order. So you've got to remember the person is still on an order. And two, that they can be monitored appropriately so that, again, as I said before, not near schools, not near children, child-friendly activities. And if it does happen to be a block of units, then what safeguards are put in place, who's living there and so on.
There's been a lot of discussion recently that some of these offenders are receiving funding from the NDIS, the National Disability Insurance Scheme, and Bill Shorten, the minister responsible for the NDIS, says this scheme shouldn't be used as a dumping ground. I guess it raising serious issues around the difference between funding for community protection,
yes,
funding for rehabilitation and then treatment. And I guess they're all different things. What are your thoughts about this tension? Because it seems to me a very real one.
I think there is a real tension. I don't dispute that. We have had a number of offenders who receive NDIS packages. The thing that I need to stress here is that they are people who have finished their sentence. So they're living in the community at whatever level, whether it be Kerala or that's restrictive or in a less restrictive environment. But they are human beings and they are entitled if they are assessed appropriately. We're not involved in any of that. The authority is not involved in any of that. However, we do know that a number of offenders have been assessed, and many of our offenders have quite complex problems. It is, of course, in the community's interest to make sure that the community is safe and that people such as who we're talking about receive appropriate treatment and rehabilitation. That is, as I mentioned before, the second aim or main principle for the post-sentence authority. So we need to ensure that they do receive treatment and rehabilitation. But as I said, we're not involved in the NDIS scheme as to who gets what, when, how. That has in many ways nothing at all to do with the post-sentence authority.
I'm not expecting you to talk to a particular case, but there have been reports in The Age that one Victorian sex offender, I think he's known as RXR, he's set to receive a $1.4 million package from the NDIS and might in the next few months, I believe nothing is finalised, could be housed in a unit out in the community. And the cost of round-the-clock supervision by two staff will be funded by the NDIS. And the discussion is around a blurring of the community protection goals, which this supervision suggests, and disability support, which I assume is diagnosed with a disability in order to qualify. That's a real tension, isn't it? That's an issue about who resources what.
Well, at the end of the day, that probably is the real tension, who pays for it. It's not necessarily whether they're entitled to it, but perhaps it's a question of who pays for it. Now, as I say, that is not the remit of the post-sentence authority, and my understanding is that Bill Shorten will work with the states to ensure that appropriate people get what they need in that regard. There have been some offenders who have received very large packages, such as the sort that you mentioned, which have been used to build what's called robust housing.
Secure housing.
Secure housing, which may have locks and, you know, locks on the windows and the doors and may also have support people 24/7, that is during the day and at night. One of the jobs, as I mentioned before, for the post-sentence authority is to look at and deem whether it's appropriate or not for an offender to live at whatever property has been sourced. And so whilst we would not get involved in anything to do with the funding, but if a property was recommended, such as what you've mentioned, then it may be that we would deem that to be appropriate. But as I say, you're talking about a number of different agencies doing different things and responsible for different things, I guess. it's also important to emphasise that the support people would accompany them when they go outside to shopping and so on. So that needs to be paid for too.
And also needs to be organised in a way that ensures the safety of those NDIS people. That's another big area of discussion.
The training of support staff is something that's really important, but again, it's not something that we would get involved. We might ask those questions, have they undergone training, you know, in order to determine whether the property is appropriate or not, because clearly that could be an issue.
At what point do corrections step back and people like NDIS or other government agencies step in?
It's not one I can answer, in fairness.
These are fascinating and really complex issues. Michelle Williams, you're such an interesting choice as the founding chair of this organisation because, of course, for many years you were a senior prosecutor, a really tough senior prosecutor. I first came
known
across
as
you.
Being tough, yes.
Yes, known as being tough. I came across you, I think, 10, 15 years ago.
Yes.
when I did a kind of a documentary series about one of the cases you ran. So there is a bit of an irony that once you would have been calling for life sentences and throw away the key for these kinds of offenders, and now you're dealing with them and engaging with them and dialoguing with them as they are released.
Yeah, there is an absolute irony with that. And I think even more so because the post-sentence authority came into existence after the murder of Marsha Vukotic by Sean Price.
And, who you prosecuted.
And I prosecuted him for that murder. And it was, you know, there were clearly a number of concerns in that case, in that Sean Price was a serious sex offender. He was at Corella, but they had released him, but his tendency for violence was increasing. And in fact, he had said that he wanted to kill someone. At that time, Corella was there and there were orders for sex offenders, but there wasn't the, if you like, post-sentence monitoring for violent offenders. So the government of the day commissioned an inquiry, and the main recommendation being the establishment of an independent body to monitor these people. And that's how the post-sentence authority came into existence. So, yes, me being chair, it does have that lovely irony about it. And, yes, even myself, sometimes I've thought, well, exactly as you put it, I was asking for life sentences and here I am now saying, no, these people need to be treated and rehabilitated. But, you know, at the end of the day, we're talking about protection of the community, and that's the main goal and always has been at the heart of the work that I do. And so, to me, whilst it may seem contradictory, it's not. It's totally consistent and with the work that I did as a senior Crown Prosecutor.
Michelle Williams, KC, who's just stepped down as Chair of the Victorian Post-Sentence Authority, thank you for speaking to The Law Report.
Thank you for having me.
That's all we have time for today. Big thanks to producer Christina Cucoglia and also to sound engineer Angie Grant. You can follow The Law Report on the ABC Listen app. And if you find us on any other podcast platform, please do leave us a review, a like, a star rating. It helps others find the program. I'm Damien Carrick. Until next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.